You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
When crisis hits, we don't turn against each other. No, we listen to each other. We lean on each other because we are always stronger together.
Michelle Obama gets all the way through her speech to the Democratic National Convention without once cribbing anything from Ann Romney. See, it's not difficult. But how worried about a rowdy crowd should Hillary Clinton really be? My guests James Boyce and Alessio Patilano will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including US Secretary of State John Kerry's imminent first meeting with Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte. What do they really want from each other? Also, the UK's plans for a post-EU trade relationship with China, and Tonga's chances of gold at the 2018 Winter Olympics. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to the programme. My guests today are James Boyce, political historian specialising in the United States, author most recently of Hillary Rising, and Alessio Patilano, lecturer in war studies at King's College. Welcome both. And we will start in Philadelphia with the Democratic National Convention, which opened yesterday and for a while there threatened to make its Republican predecessor look a relative model of order and sanity, as unruly adherents of defeated candidate Senator Bernie Sanders booed every mention of Hillary Clinton's name with a gusto rarely matched by the most ardent GOP Tea Partier. A measure of decorum was restored with a conciliatory address by Sanders and a speech by Michelle Obama, which caused many to wonder whether the right First Lady was running for president. Let's hear a little of both. We will start with Mrs. Obama.
I want a president who will teach our children that everyone in this country matters. A president who truly believes in the vision that our founders put forth all those years ago, that we are all created equal, each a beloved part of the great American story. And when crisis hits, we don't turn against each other. No, we listen to each other. We lean on each other because we are always stronger together. And I am here tonight because I know that that is the kind of president that Hillary Clinton will be. And that's why in this election, I'm with her.
We need leadership in this country which will improve the lives of working families, which brings our people together, not leadership which insults Latinos and Mexicans, insults Muslims and women, African Americans and veterans, and seeks to divide us up. Hillary Clinton must become the next president of the United States.
Bernie Sanders before that, Michelle Obama. James, first of all, is it possible to imagine the actual candidate's speech a couple of nights hence prompting quite the same delirium as either of those?
It's really important to remember that if you look back across the history of American political conventions, the actual nominee speech is never the one that's remembered. It's always somebody else's. I think there's a number of reasons for that, not least of which is that they've got to do so much in one speech, trying to appeal to so many people. Think about what Hillary Clinton's going to have to do.
Upsetting so many people.
Absolutely. You know, you've got to do so much and try and cover so much material and also do it succinctly. Because you could say, well, okay, you could talk on forever, but then Donald Trump spoke for far too long last week. If you look back across conventions past, it's always someone else, often the losing candidate. You know, 1980, it's Ted Kennedy's speech that everybody remembers from that convention. People are going to be talking about Michelle Obama's speech last night for years to come. It was a remarkable piece of work, and she did a great deal to bring harmony to an evening which had threatened at one point to get out of control. Even, I think, Bernie Sanders, when he was speaking at the breakfast talk before the convention, was very concerned, I think, that he had let something out of the Pandora's box, and he was forced to tweet and email to his supporters saying, please, as a personal favour for me, do not protest on the floor. It'll embarrass me and yourselves.
Alessio, it is a standard received wisdom that the the public doesn't like a divided party and that any kind of internecine rancor plays badly. Is that really the case, though? Do voters really mind a bit of good old-fashioned booing? Doesn't it sort of suggest an actually lively and engaged and, you know, party having a debate amongst itself?
I think you're absolutely right. That is natural, normal, expected. It should be expected, and it's healthy. It shows that there is diversity of opinions. There is multiple views, and there is a sense of engagement, as you said. But I suppose here, what matters very much is also the context. We're coming out of the Republican convention that was very chaotic. It was very unsettling in many respects, and I think many were expecting the Democratic convention to be a beacon of hope, of things that you should be doing, to show a degree of cohesiveness, if you want, show the other side of the face of politics, one that precisely brings people together and sort of reduces the gap that we've seen growing over most issues over the past few months, and indeed sort of raising the big question as this division that plays to the strength of the populist politicians or the populist figures like Donald Trump.
James, what do you think? I just start to wonder myself whether it's sort of the equivalent of fights in football games. You know, when they happen, everybody pretends to be outraged and appalled and think it's dreadful for the game. But obviously the crowds think they're fantastic fun.
Yeah, what's fascinating is that over the last couple of election cycles, you know, everybody's basically been saying, look, these conventions have become just rubber stamping exercises. We know who the candidates are going to be going in. It's very formulaic. It's choreographed within an inch of its life for the TV cameras.
They're infomercials, basically.
They absolutely
go on
are.
For 4 days.
Yeah, and you've had cases in the past where the networks in the States have actually said, we're not going to start showing blanket coverage of this anymore because they are just party political broadcasts. So they've been editing it down severely. That clearly isn't the case this time around. And for the first time in generations, arguably, we've got some interesting things coming out of these conventions. What's worth noting, though, is that both parties arguably have been hijacked by outsiders. Mm. Donald Trump is not a conservative. He's not a Republican. He is someone who has basically taken over the party very well from his point of view. Bernie Sanders is not even a Democrat. He's an independent. And he's brought a whole new group of people into the Democratic Party. And if you look at the emails that have come out, so many of them have actually been up in arms because they're basically saying, hang on a second, you aren't a Democrat. You know, you've come here and you're trying to tell us how to run our party. Now, the idea that the party leadership would take umbrage at that shouldn't surprise anybody, nor should the fact that the superdelegates were never for Bernie Sanders. They were also always for the establishment candidate, which is Hillary Clinton this time round. But it's only a reversal of what was going on 8 years ago when she got shafted because the same party leadership were for Barack Obama.
Just to follow that point up, James, about the emails, these emails among the Democratic National Committee, which have been leaked via WikiLeaks, there is the obvious suggestion that there's more where this came from and they might not have unleashed the really good stuff yet. It's kind of unknowable, I grant you, but how potentially damaging could this be to Clinton and to the Democratic Party?
See, I don't think it's going to be damaging to Hillary Clinton personally because we're not talking about communications that she's been involved in. We're talking about party apparatus at the very top. It's already toppled the party leadership and the party chairwoman, which is something that must be said Bernie Sanders was after. I think actually someone who could come out of this very, very poorly is Assange and the whole WikiLeaks organization. If it's demonstrated that there is some sort of collusion with Moscow, for example, that there was some collusion between Moscow, WikiLeaks and the Republicans, it looks very, very bad indeed and could be a 21st century Watergate.
Alessio, there's been a lot of talk about Michelle Obama's speech, which was very good, obviously. She is a fine speaker and she has good writers, but she has things to say as well. Did you get the impression that we were witnessing the beginning of another political dynasty there, perhaps?
I think it's impossible not to think that. And I think that is something that you've seen growing already for a number of years, because she was very active. She had issues she cared about. She was the first lady that stood out as a person on its own terms, and her speech has done exactly the same thing. I think she made reference to Barack, but she did it in a very sort of first lady emphasis, if you want, talking about her daughters. I think there was a point, and also punctuating her speech in a way as a very sort of good seasoned politicians would be. I mean, one of the points that I found was particularly striking to me was when she was talking about, the focus was on her daughters, and then all of a sudden she talks about, well, my daughters have been playing in the lawn of the White House, a house that was built by slaves. I was like, whoa. You know, that's
she's the first lady that I can recall actually acknowledging that.
Absolutely. And I think having the courage and the ability to put that in the right context, it says a lot about the person, not just about the writers, but also about the charisma and the political attitude. So I wouldn't be surprised if what we're looking at is the beginning, if you want, of a comeback. And if Hillary goes through, we actually have a precedent for that. So, you know, it wouldn't be as unnatural as some would consider now.
A final thought from you, I guess, on the same subject, James. I mean, that path now does exist from First Lady to the Senate to cabinet posting to a shot at the presidency. Is it imaginable that Michelle Obama might have thought the same thing?
You know, it's not unimaginable, but what I would say is that you've got to have the correct set of political criteria in place for that to happen. You know, one of the things I try to point out in the book I wrote earlier in the year is that, incredibly enough, you can make a valid argument that Hillary Clinton's entire political career owes a great deal to Monica Lewinsky because of that relationship that occurred. It created the political space and the political sympathy to allow Hillary Clinton to move from the First Lady position to seek a position within New York. It's all about political timing. And no matter how astute Michelle Obama may or may not be, and certainly on the evidence of last night and other speeches, she's a very, very canny deliverer of a speech. There has to be a political opening for her to move into, whether that's back home in Illinois, possibly. But it's also being said in other circles that actually she can't wait to leave the White House and go back to having a degree of privacy to have reestablish a relationship with her husband and her children and to have some time out of the limelight.
Okay, well, let's look now at the Philippines, where at roughly lunchtime local time tomorrow, the country's uncompromising new president, Rodrigo Duterte, will host U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. The countries are, of course, allies of long standing, but the two men could scarcely be more different. Kerry, a polished professional statesman who lost a presidential election for knowing how to speak French, and Duterte, a bellicose proto-Trump who revels in playing the authoritarian hard man. Alessio, is there a chance, do we think, that Rodrigo Duterte has started to wonder how good a friend the United States really is to the Philippines?
I think that's always been there, and it's not just the ex-president. This is one of the, I think, one of the pillars of the way that the Philippines relates to the United States. And in a way, if you want, the game that the Chinese have been played, particularly insofar as the maritime territorial disputes out China Sea are concerned, is just reinforced, if you want, the strategic importance of the Philippines to the United States, empowering them even more so than that had been over the past few years, if you want, of that sort of possibility to have a bargaining chip to negotiate with the United States. That's part of the relationship. Having said so, it's also a very intimate relationship. American military advises and is present across all the different levels of the Filipino military, from the very heart of the neurologic centers of the Filipino Ministry of Defense and the Armed Forces, down to regular exercises, so the ability actually to maintain a certain degree of readiness. And that is true not just militarily, but also in terms of economic penetration. So whilst it is important, and I think it's always been there, the ability of the Philippines to negotiate good deals with the United States, and an ability that has now increased, I think there's also a limit to how far you can push. And I think what we've seen so far, especially over the past 2 years, certainly since 2012, and after the submission to the for the arbitration case, is an increased value of the Philippines to the United States, and also an understanding in the Philippines that the United States can be leveraged against China. And by the way, I think one of the best examples of this is how Duterte, shortly before the ruling came out, started talking. You know, as soon as he was elected, the first thing he says, like, we're happy to go back and talk to the Chinese, and very cunningly waited until the ruling came out, because that gave him further leverage, this time with China. So using the United States on the one hand and the ruling on the other as a way to go into the negotiating table. Very cunning.
James, Rodrigo Duterte would hardly be the first authoritarian hard man that the United States has found itself having to deal with. He's not even the first Filipino authoritarian hard man the United States has found itself having to deal with. Will his, and again I'm going to use the tactful word uncompromising again, approach to certain issues of domestic law and order make any difference to the U.S.-Filipino relationship, or is it one of those sort of permanent interests?
I think it's going to be one of these things. You know, the United States has long said, oh, you know, we stand on the side of the angels and we want to promote democracy and freedom, etc., etc., etc. But time and time and time again, you know, realpolitik trumps ideology, effectively. And we've seen this throughout history and across various geographical locations. You know, we go back to the Marcos regime very, very simply with regard to the Philippines as a result of that. But, you know, time and again, the United States finds itself caught between these two very contradictory positions. And quite frankly, it's disappointing, I think, from an ideological point of view, that it finds itself inclined to adopt the realpolitik position. But one can understand why when you consider the challenges it faces in that part of the world and the need to have allies in that part of the world.
I mean, that's absolutely right. But I think there are situations whereby, especially in the Philippines, the relationship with the Philippines, as I said, it's very intimate, it's a long-standing, it's a historical relationship. The United States wasn't really sort of, limping out on the blue to get a sense of who was going to be the next president. People knew that this was an option, had contingency plans. And that intimate relationship, of course, works two ways. You know, there is a way to temperate this uncompromising behavior because the United States do hold certain cards close to their chest. I mean, the same way, the president in the Philippines knows that he's a negotiating a capacity that he has when it comes to China by using mobilizing the United States, that's also a limitation and a constraint. Of course, as I said, we're looking at the situation that is very much realpolitik, that is about the practicalities, but I wouldn't dismiss the ability, precisely because of that level of connection between two countries, under the surface, to try to sort of rein them in and put a cap, if you want, on top of what would be otherwise a very uncompromising, unrestrained type of behaviour.
But just to follow that up, to what extent is Duterte, do we think, able to play Beijing and Washington against each other? I mean, since the judgment in Philippines' favour in the Permanent Court of Arbitration, he's already come up with the interesting suggestion that he's happy to set aside whatever objections the Philippines might have had if China will build the Philippines a railway network.
Yes. Well, at the same time, he also nominated a special envoy to deal with China, one of the former presidents of the Philippines that is also has been one of the toughest individuals when it comes to relationship with China. I think what we're talking about, and this is the experience of the local politician. Duterte, to my mind, it looks like a tough local politician that knows how to play rough. And that's how he's going to deploy when it comes to the relationship with China. And he will know that there are boundaries, there are limits, and I think he has an understanding of the extent to which he can play the Chinese-American cards against each other.
James, final thought on this. There have been many comparisons made between Senor Duterte and Donald Trump, of course. Weirdly and possibly dishearteningly, since actually getting elected, Duterte has proved incredibly popular. Is this a concern from the United States point of view?
You know, it's remarkable. If you think about what it is that that Trump is putting forward, you know, we look about it and we look on with horror in many ways from Europe. And yet, clearly, he is appealing to a certain base demographic within the United States. I guess, you know, I would never claim to be an expert in Philippine affairs, but you can get a great degree of short-term popularity by addressing rather base issues and bringing in this sort of populist card. Trump is tapping into something which is obviously seen as being particularly abhorrent from a European perspective, but you know, he is keying into something which is a groundswell of mass unpopularity and unfamiliarity and discontent with politics as normal in the United States. I think he's going to come up short, it must be said, and I certainly hope so, but there is a groundswell of support which is very, very strong for him at this point.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with James Boyce and Alessio Patilano. Coming up next, the UK makes trade inroads post-Brexit, but what is the final destination?
Monocle's summer travel-themed sister publication, The Escapist, is back for a second outing. Printed in the same compact form as our winter forecast, it takes you to 10 lesser-known cities around the world, with sunny stories to tell. And here's the Monocle team to guide you on your way.
I headed to St. John's, the most easterly point in North America, to see how the Canadian city that doesn't quite feel Canadian is coping with the end of the oil boom.
To bring a bit of sunshine to proceedings, I hopped on a flight to Sicily to visit the island's capital of Palermo. But although it is often preceded by its shadowy reputation as the erstwhile home of the mafia, the Sicilian capital is today stepping into the light. A dynamic mayor with an ambitious plan and a new generation of young entrepreneurs are helping Palermo to fulfill its majestic potential.
The Escapist is on newsstands now. Get yours today or become a subscriber at monocle.com and never miss out.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are James Boyce and Alessio Patilano. Now, it is a little less than 5 weeks since the United Kingdom voted to leave the European Union. While it remains far from clear when this will ever actually happen and in what form, the UK's new government has begun wondering out loud what that future might look like. Newly installed Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Hammond, has revealed that preliminary discussions have been held with China about a free trade agreement. Alessio, these discussions have presumably been extremely preliminary because the UK is not supposed to be able to negotiate anything until it leaves the EU.
Yes. So they're very preliminary, but at the same time, I think
How preliminary are we talking? Sort of, hi, my name's Philip.
No. I think we're a few steps down that road. Well, first of all, I think they're not as preliminary as one would expect, particularly when it comes to China, for a very simple reason that UK-China relations, economic relations, have changed dramatically. The UK in 2011 was trailing behind every other major European country when it comes to trade with China. Now is one of the top partners in certain areas, actually, is the top European partner for China. And there is a great element of complementarity between the Chinese and the British economy. British excels in services and finished sort of manufactured goods. The Chinese need services and also need to improve how they produce their manufactured goods. And also they are very good at investing into big infrastructural projects, which incidentally is something that the UK doesn't really have or certainly needs. So there's already a discussion ongoing and the different, if you want, issues are already on the table. Now, the fact that the issues are on the table means that Philip knows already his counterparts, and certainly if not Philip, everybody who works around Philip knows that. To what extent that will happen, well, I suppose that depends very much when Article 50 start being triggered. But once that starts being triggered, then it becomes part of a bigger package. The fact that civil servants and the people around the Chancellor are already working on this, well, it's because economic relationship will not materialise after Article 50 is triggered. They're already there in place.
James, from a domestic political point of view, isn't this slightly weird, given that it seems like a matter of, well, funnily enough, about 5 weeks since we were all blaming China for destroying what was left of the UK steel industry?
It's a fair point. One of the things I think to consider with regard to this is if we're talking about, you know, the extent to which the UK can have trade negotiations, and we were talking there about we can't have preliminary conversations until Article 50 is triggered, etc., etc., etc. But so much of that focuses upon internal EU debate about what the continuing relationship is going to be. It's important to remember the United Kingdom has bilateral trading negotiations and deals outside of its EU relationship already. There was an awful lot of, Alessio talks there about this, the upturn in UK Sino trade over the last couple of years under David Cameron. One of the things that Cameron was doing very, very astutely was also trying to reposition us with regard to India, for example, and making sure that that became a very important bilateral trading agreement as well. So, you know, we can look at what Liam Fox has done and announced in the last couple of days with regards to the opening of three new trading offices across the United States to make sure that US-UK trading negotiations and positions become updated as we move forward. clearly, you know, the next 2 years are going to be very, very complicated vis-a-vis the UK's relationship with the European Union and getting access to, I guess, what we'll have to call the common market and the idea of free goods and trade within the European model. But the idea of that we're somehow stymied with regards to going out and negotiating bilateral trade with anybody else outside of Europe, I think is something which we can and we will be doing irrespective of whatever Brussels may or may not like at this point.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we shall look to Tonga, which is not a dateline we cover often, and less often still, for obvious reasons, in the context of winter sports. However, Tonga, lest we forget, did send a team to Sochi in 2014, consisting of two officials and luge rider Fuheya Semi, who changed his name to Bruno Banani to market the German lingerie manufacturer of that name, and finished 32nd. Undeterred, Tonga has announced plans to send a larger contingent to the 2018 Winter Games in Pyeongchang, a team of skiers. Alessio, first of all, do we fancy their chances?
Oh, absolutely. This thing reminds me. This thing reminds me of an advert, the advertisement that Fiat used to support the bobski team of Jamaica, something like that, many years ago.
The Jamaican bobsledders,
exactly.
Yes.
And you know, these underdogs. There's something about. I think there's something about the original spirit of the Olympic Games. Whenever there is an underdog, someone that shouldn't be there, that is so odd, and it really is about that spirit. It's about that genuine commitment, that passion. That drives anyone who wants to go for sports. So I'm all for it. I'm looking forward to it.
A thing I did learn, which I didn't know when I woke up this morning, was that there actually is a Royal Tonga Ski Federation.
Yes.
If those people have managed to actually get public funding and salaries paid from the public purse, my hat is off. I mean, because that would take nerve, that pitch, wouldn't it? So I'd like to go to whoever makes these decisions in Tonga and say, I think we need a ski federation. James, from a soft power perspective, what is in it for a country to fail gloriously on the world stage? I'm thinking at this point of, for example, the famous Eric the Eel Musawi, who became the world's only famous equatorial Ghanaian after just about finishing the 100 metres in Sydney in 2000.
You see, I thought you were going to raise the England football team at every competition I appreciate as an Australian, it's biting your
attention. Manfully above that joke.
Well, as the Englishman in the room, it's a matter of great regret. You know, I think they're going to get there and it's going to be all downhill. Yes, Alessio is absolutely right. The idea that everybody loves an underdog. You know, there was a movie that came out this summer about Eddie the Eagle, you know,
yes.
Someone who was a complete and utter joke, quite frankly.
Did he not project an image to the world of Britain as a nation of hapless bunglers?
Well, it's not the way that many of us would like England to be or Britain to be recognised on the world stage. But certainly, I think if you can't win, come last and do it with a degree of grace, quite frankly.
I mean, Alessio, is what I start to worry about is, and I return to the example of Eric the Eel Musawi, it goes very quickly. There's a very fine line, isn't there, between everybody cheering on the underdog and well played for having a go. And then you kind of get to the point of, isn't this a bunch of rich countries having a bit of a laugh at poor countries that aren't really competing?
I mean, you can always play the cynical side of things. And Andrew, I know that you are wholeheartedly generous about the cynicism of life. But let's put it this way. Yes, you're absolutely right. You can see that side. But as I said, when it comes to sports, I mean, personally, if I'm following an international sports competition, I like to think and I'd like to look for what it is. That is the embodiment of a particular type of approach to life, a way to fight, within the rules of the game, even though the Russians would disagree with that these days. but I think that's what I would focus on. Having said so, yes, of course, does Tonga need to go to the Winter Olympics? Not necessarily. I'm sure that their tourism won't really suffer from that. But as I said, it's the two faces of the same coin, and it depends very much which one you want to focus on.
I shall be cheering them on anyway, possibly because they might be the only people in the world who are actually worse skiers than I am, which would be an accomplishment. Alessio Patalano and James Boyes, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Patrick Hun, Jacob Ladona and Sai Villafuerte. And our studio manager was Chris Grimes. There's more music next at 1900. It's Section D with Henry Rhys Sheridan and Josh Fennett. And there's more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. I'm back, I think I'm right in saying, with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.